music, session number 18209, Reel 1.
Major Leith Archery 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in Birkenhead.
Which year was this?
In 1919.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Birkenhead?
No, I went to a prep school in Hoylake called the Lees, and from there went to St Edward's School at Oxford, and then to the university, where I read forestry.
How old were you when you finished that?
I was at 1940, just at the time of Dunkirk, I did my finals. And as the situation looked pretty desperate, I decided I would join up more or less straight away. And I was in the Oxford University OTC, actually. And I joined the LDV, which was then what used to be, then became the Home Guard, for a bit. And then I was told to go to Dunbar to the OCTU there. Before I went there, I had a letter from the India office saying, would you like to go to India as a cadet and join the Indian Army subsequently? And that sounded an attractive proposition, so that's what happened. And I was called up to Aldershot in December 1940, where 500 of us from public schools and universities who were enlisted into the Royal Scots as private soldiers and called cadets. And we sailed to India on January the 11th, 1941. And it took 7 weeks to get to round the Cape to get to India. And from it, we landed in Bombay and got onto a troop train to Bangalore and started 6 months training at the what was then called the Cadet College at Bangalore. The training really was largely aimed at frontier warfare. The Japanese war hadn't started. And all the Japanese hadn't joined the war. And people really dismissed the Japanese as not important. And nobody seemed to think they ever would join the war at that time. So we spent a lot of training as if we were going up onto the frontier or internal security in India. As it happened, at the end of 6 months, I joined the 3rd, 9th Gurkha Rifles in Waziristan. It's interesting perhaps to note that the reason why I chose the 9th Gurkha Rifles was because my sister-in-law had three brothers in the regiment already, so I thought I might as well join them. As it happened, I didn't, because they were in different battalions. But I spent 6 months on the front, 6 months on the frontier, and really enjoyed it there. It was a wonderful place to serve and a wonderful opportunity to, as a second lieutenant company commander, to learn the language. No way better to learn the language than being thrown in at the deep end, as it were, with people who didn't speak any English anyhow. And get to know the Gurkhas, as I did, intimately, really, during those months on the frontier.
Was there any shooting there whilst you were serving?
Yes. The Pathans used to snipe at us from the at night, mostly, from the hills round the camp. We had pickets out on some of the hills, which one visited occasionally. But our main job, really, was to patrol the road up to from Banu to Razmak, which was, I think, the highest up British post in the British Empire at the time. And we had to go out early in the morning and put pickets on the hills along the road to make certain that the Pathans didn't shoot up the convoy of vehicles.
Did any of your Gurkhas fall casualty to the shooting?
Not at the time I was there, no.
What kind of impression did you get at first of your Gurkhas as fighting troops?
The thing that amazed me was, when we first got there, was the keenness of them doing any particular job or training that they had to do, and the wonderful discipline, really. The Gurkha officers really dealt with any minor misdemeanor, and as a company commander, one really just had to run the administration, and the Gurkha officers really did all the work, you might say, running the company. The impression I got was of really dedicated soldiers, thoroughly loyal and very cheerful. For instance, they spent each on these pickets, they spent a whole week up on the top of these hills in a sort of stone sangar, as it were, with a tent on the top and snow, and it was very cold from September onwards, and never any complaints. The only shooting that ever took place when I was there during the night turned out to be not a Pathan who had crept up to the picket, but a porcupine, in fact, which was shot and eaten, I think.
What did the attitude seem to be towards you as an inexperienced subaltern?
Very helpful. The Gurkha officer was extremely helpful. And we had a sort of mutual interest in birds, actually. He was very keen on birds, and so was I. And a lot of our conversation while sitting waiting for the convoy to go past was about the birds and the flowers and the lammergeiers which flew past, the bearded vultures and all these things. And that was one of the reasons why, one of the ways one got to know people or know the Gurkha officers in my company.
What was agitating the Pathans in Waziristan at the time?
Well, they're always fighting one another and always wanting to get hold of weapons. And if they could surprise a party and kill a few people and capture a few rifles, that was a great thing and feather in their cap, as it were. And the Fakir Ripi in the previous decade, I think, had been campaigning against the British. And it also acted as an extremely good training area for the Indian Army and parts of the British Army which were attached to the Indian Army. Not only the Army, actually, but also the RAF, which gave us a lot of Gloucester Gladiators and planes like that. Used to fly over and do spotting for the artillery. And so the RAF were also involved, and it was, I suppose, a necessary minor war, but it provided a lot of training and enabled one to realize what it was like to be shot at, really.
What was the attitude of the British officers and the Gurkha soldiers towards the Pathans?
Well, they were just the Dushman, the enemy, and that was that. I mean, they didn't like any enemy, but anyone who was anti-British or against the British was their enemy, and that was that.
So you said you were there for 6 months, during which I think Pearl Harbor occurred.
That's right. Pearl Harbor occurred, and I remember the sinking of the Prince of Wales and the Repulse. I remember hearing that news whilst we were up there.
I think you then saw service with the same battalion in the Arakan.
That's right. We went there in, I think it was March 42, and took part in what in effect was a retreat, really. It was an extremely unpleasant experience, which I have described in this book with the Gurkhas. And the Japs advanced up the Malayan Peninsula as far as a place called Butidong, and we spent the monsoon as the foremost, one of the foremost battalions, a place called Tong Bazar, sending out patrols just to make certain what the Japs were up to. And during that time, they never, in fact, advanced any further. And by the time we left, the situation was still fairly static there. We left, I think, in about September 1942. 43, sorry, 43. And went to Assam for a rest period.
What specifically was so unpleasant about the experience?
Getting to know the Jap tactics and responding to them. The first time they attacked us was at night, and they rushed around the perimeter shouting in English and Gurkhali, making noises like lizards and doing all sorts of odd things, which upset, really upset the Gurkhas, and upset me too, I must say, wondering what on earth was going on. And what they were trying to do, and what they succeeded in doing in our case in the first instance, was to get our men to open fire so they could see where the positions were. And we fell into that trap straight away through total inexperience. And we had to withdraw during the night from that position after this rather unnerving experience. And the morale of the battalion briefly was bad because we reckoned we hadn't done a good job. And I think that happened to most battalions the first time they ever met the Japs. But once you'd done that and realised what they were up to, the situation completely changed. And when we got to Tong Bazar, as I mentioned, on the front, down the front there, the morale was high, and the men knew exactly what the Japs were up to and how they went about their business. And from then onwards, for the rest of the war, the men knew exactly what was what, and never again were taken in by the Japs.
What kind of a sound does a lizard make?
Tuck-to, tuck-to, tuck-to. Extraordinary noise. It went all night like that.
And once the Japanese had determined by these jittering tactics where the location of the guns, what did they then do?
Well, they were expecting, I presume, to come back the next night. They didn't realise we were going to retire. They didn't do anything that night, actually. But I've no doubt that the following night they would have actually put in a proper attack rather than just a jitter bug.
What did the attitude of the local population in the Butidong area seem to be towards the approach of Japanese forces?
I think there were two sorts of population. There were the virtually Bengali people who just accepted anything that went on. I mean, just were going to be ruled by somebody. It makes no difference whether it's the British or the Japs. And they didn't care two hoots. But there were some people called the Maroons who lived up in the mountains a bit around there, whom we met quite often. And they were definitely anti-Japanese and helped us and did lots of work for us, putting up bamboo huts and things like that.
What were they called?
Maroons, M-A-R-U-N-G-S.
Why do you think they were anti-Japanese?
It was the same throughout Burma, actually. The hill people. The hill people were, in fact, anti-Burmese as such. And I think they felt that helping the British might help them to do the Burmese down, as it were, the actual Burmese themselves, as opposed to the hill tribes round about. And of course, later on, we had a lot of help from the Kachins, too.
Did you see anything of the plight of refugees in this area?
No. No, it was fairly sparsely populated, the Arakan Peninsula, mostly along the coast. And no, we didn't. I didn't see anything like that at all.
Was it a healthy or an unhealthy area to operate in?
Unhealthy, I think. I mean, there were loads of mosquitoes and things, and some of the men got malaria, or in some cases heat stroke, but and of course prickly heat and that sort of thing. But yes, I mean, a tropical country like that, when you can't wash properly, really, or lead a more or less civilized life, you do tend to get odd skin diseases and things like that. But
did the battalion provide anything in the way of prophylaxis against malaria for the men?
Not then. We did. Mepocrine was issued later on, but not in 1943, as far as I remember.
I think this is 1943, Wayne.
Yeah.
What other units were operating in your area in the Arakan?
The 88th Punjab Regiment took over from us in Tong Bazar, I remember that. And the 6th to 11th Sikhs were with us in our brigade. And we were in 26th Indian Division, actually. And I can't remember the other units.
Now, you were just about to tell me about after the Arakan, and I think we're coming on to perhaps the second Chindit expedition.
Yes, we went for a 6 months rest period in a very nice part of Assam called Mainamati. And whilst we were there, we got news that we were going to be part of the second Chindit force. And our role was to be the garrison battalion of the airfield, which they intended to set up in northern Burma behind the Jap lines. So we did a lot of training for that, training to get in and out of aeroplanes and carrying these 60-pound packs for long ways and route marches and things like that. And we had a visit from at the time, actually, Lord Louis Mountbatten became Supreme Commander of Southeast Asia, and he issued an edict that the members of the forces should, in fact, tell their parents and other people much more about their lives, as it were, rather than just saying I can't say where I am, and that's that. Of course, it didn't affect the Gurkhas much, but the officers were able to. I was able to tell my parents how I was living, and living in a tent, and how we got on, but
that, of course, would tell them that you were in the Burma Theatre.
Well, yes. I mean, I didn't actually say that, but I think one way I got round the censorship was, before I left, I bought two Indian bird books. Left one at home and took the other out with me. And in my letters I was able to say I'd just seen this or that bird. And when I was able to say I'd just seen a greater hornbill, they could look up and see that the greater hornbill was mostly in Assam and Burma. So in that way they got to know where I was, actually. Whilst we were there, and we'd been told that we were joining the Chindit force, General Wingate paid us a visit. And I was adjutant at the time, and he sent a message saying, I want the battalion to dig a 20-foot square sand pit and mark it out with 1-foot square tapes, grid, naked grid with tapes. And so I chose a spot, and we dug like hell, digging up the sand and putting sand in and trying to find enough tape to make these grid lines, and just got it done in time. And the following morning we were waiting for the general to come, and there were a cloud of dust in the distance, which turned out to be the general galloping on a white horse that had been dyed khaki, and he sort of reared up in front of us rather like a cowboy in a film, jumped off the horse. He was wearing this strange topi he always wore, and he was also had a beard against the king's regulations, and he saluted the CO without bothering to take his cane out of his hand. And then I'd chosen a place where we could sit raised up looking down onto this sand pit. And all he did was he made us sit in the sand pit and then stood on the raised bit where I thought we were going to sit and gave us a little talk, which I must say was very good and a very, very heartening talk. And then he jumped off his horse and galloped away almost in the same cloud of dust. And that was a sort of behaviour that went on, eccentric behaviour.
What was the gist of what he said? The
gist of what he said was, you're going to insert yourselves into the Japanese guts, and you're going to upset his lines of communication and make it that much more difficult for the Japs to move up supplies to the SM front round Imphal and where the main battles are taking place. And I must say, he had a remarkable capacity for anticipating what the Japs would do in any given situation, which we subsequently discovered. And on the whole, although I personally felt rather slighted having dug this wretched pit, on the whole, everyone was inspired by what he'd said and felt that we were going to do something worth doing.
But presumably the Gurkhas couldn't understand him anyway.
No, well, they weren't there. It was only British officers he wanted to talk to. To go back a bit, Mountbatten paid us a visit. And he'd learned a little speech in Gurkhali off Pat. He jumped up onto his box and made this little speech in Gurkhali. It was hugely impressive, actually. there was a king's cousin talking their own language. I thought that was terrific.
Could you understand it?
Yes.
What was the gist of that one?
Oh, you're not a forgotten army anymore kind of thing. You know.
Had you heard of the reputation of Wingate before he made this dramatic appearance?
Yes. Yes, I think we had. I expected something unusual.
So, did you then start training for the Chind at work?
Well, yes, we had been training before he came and doing route marches with heavy packs and trying to get to grips with these K rations that we were going to be issued with, the American K rations, which for British troops were understandable. Gurkhas found them a bit odd, I must say, and eventually made all sorts of concoctions out of mixing various things together. There were three meals. There was a breakfast, what they called dinner, and then supper. And they had various things in them, cheese and chocolate and soup powder and coffee and cigarettes.
By the way, just going back to the horse, how did you know it was white dyed carpet?
Well, bits of it were white.
What other preparations did you have to make for going into Burma?
Our mules had to be devoiced. Mules are inclined to make a sickening noise for no particular reason. And the noise carries an enormous distance. So that did something to their vocal cords, I don't know what, and made them practically silent. When they tried to make a noise, it merely kind of whistled. They had to be dealt with, and we were all issued with I can't remember the name of the rifle, but it was a sort of automatic rifle, which replaced the Lee Enfield ones which we had before.
I think you were a company commander both in the Arakan and in the Chindits. Which company did you have?
D Company.
In both?
Hmm.
And where did your Gurkhas come from in particular?
Mostly Western Nepal. They were... was the only Gurkha regiment which enlisted Tarkas and Chetri Gurkhas, which were slightly higher caste than the Muggers and Gurungs and the Rais and Limbus of the other regiments.
Could you tell a Tarko from a Chetri?
Yes, the Chetris tended to be rather, had slightly more what you might call Indian features, less Mongolian looking. The Tarkas were slightly Mongolian, but not quite so Mongolian as the Muggers and Gurungs.